This is Beverly Tomasian. I'm really excited to have this course today, our third in the series of our diabetes fundamentals. Today's topic is insulin pattern management. So we're going to be talking about a lot of exciting topics regarding insulin, how it works, teaching strategies, some new insulins, and also how to make adjustments in insulin therapy. And this for many of you, maybe you have some experience in insulin management, but for a lot of you, this topic may be a little newer. So we'll kind of go through it in a progressive type style to build on the main points and add more complicated concepts. We're going to talk about the national guidelines and incorporating those into practice. We'll use basal bolus insulin therapy to improve glucose control from the hospital to home. So we'll be looking at a variety of case studies that could take place in the hospital setting and the home setting. So no matter where we work, we're going to be involved in helping patients to strategize, improving the way they deliver insulin, because insulin dosing changes over time with the patient's body weight, their health, their kidney function. All kinds of factors affect how much insulin you need on any given day. So there has to be a lot of flexibility over a person's lifetime in making those adjustments in insulin. And then we'll take a look at glucose patterns, and we'll say, okay, if the blood sugar is doing this, what can we do to improve the outcomes and get those blood glucose levels to target? And so we'll be doing some practice in that way also. So this is, takes a lot of time working with patients to really get insulin management under your belt. So the more patients that you can work with, looking at their blood sugars, looking at their insulin, making adjustments, and of course, when I say making adjustments, I do not have prescriptive authority, so I can't tell patients adjust your insulin in this way or that way without getting the provider approval. So we're going to make these suggestions to the provider to improve blood sugar management. So kind of on that note, I want to throw out a poll there and ask all of you, do you make insulin dose or change suggestions to providers in your practice? And if you do that, do you do it frequently, sometimes, rarely, never? You would like to, but you really need some more knowledge. Okay, thanks for voting, everyone. I'll take one more second. Okay, great. Thanks so much. All of you have voted. Let me share your response. And most of you chose sometimes, rarely. Well, it's actually a three-way tie. Sometimes you do, rarely. And 33% of you said, I would like to, but I need more information. So I'm hoping that this webcast will provide you with some building blocks where you can start feeling more comfortable making suggestions for change, because I've seen so many patients in my practice who are doing everything we ask them to. They're checking their blood sugar, they're taking the insulin, and still they're not getting their blood sugars to target. And they really feel discouraged. And I feel like that's where we step in. We can look at their blood glucose and their insulin dosing strategies and suggest changes to improve that. And that really helps patients have a better quality of life and feel more in control of their diabetes. So as educators, we're definitely always advocating for our patients. So to get started, insulin therapy from ants to analog. So why do I call my talk this? Well, in the old days, you could tell that a person had diabetes because ants would be attracted to their urine. Now you wonder, why would ants be attracted to their urine? Well, there was a lot of sugar in their urine. So that was one of the signs somebody had diabetes, that ants were attracted to that sugary urine. And analogs, what does that have to do with my presentation? Well, in the old days, we used to get insulin from beef and pig pancreases. Well, now we get them from stimulating E. coli and yeast. So we'll inject DNA components into E. coli and yeast and make them work hard to produce insulin that's very similar in the amino acid structure to our body's own insulin. So the new analogs have a lot less immunity, and that people don't get allergies to them or don't reject them. So they don't have a response to them because they're so similar in their structure to our own insulin. And so what I wanted to show you again is a proinsulin chain. This is the insulin that's stored in your pancreas ready for activation. Here's the alpha chain, here's the beta chain, and this C chain is the connecting peptide. When insulin is activated and released into the bloodstream, it looks like this. Here's the active insulin molecule, just the alpha and beta chain. And this actually makes its first pass through the liver. About 50% of insulin is used by the liver, and the other 50% is liberated into the rest of our, you know, bloodstream and into our body for our other organs to utilize, like our muscle. This C-peptide chain is also cleaved off, and it makes a run through the kidneys. And so we often measure C-peptide levels to see how much endogenous insulin a person makes. Kind of looking at the history of insulin and the discovery of it, here are two of my heroes. This is Dr. Banting on the right and Dr. Best. Charles Best was still a medical student. Dr. Banting was a doctor, and he had served in World War I as a surgeon. And after World War I, he was trying to set up his practice, and there wasn't much business, so he became intrigued by this problem called diabetes. And he said, I want to help discover a treatment for type 1 diabetes. And he, through a lot of different research, was ultimately credited with a team of other providers and doctors and researchers with the discovery of insulin. But in this photo here, Banting and Best are shown outside of their lab in Toronto, Canada. This is Marjorie. And Marjorie, what happened during this experimental phase is that they were taking out the pancreases of dogs and essentially inducing type 1 diabetes. So Marjorie had her pancreas taken out, and then they would grind up the pancreases from the dogs, and they would make a solution from the pancreas. So that what they were saying is, if you don't have the pancreas, if you can extract what the pancreas makes and then re-inject it into the dog Marjorie, then they will get their blood sugars under control. And that's what happened. They took the fluid from the pancreas, is called insulin, they injected it back into Marjorie, and they watched her blood sugars come down. So Marjorie lived for 43 days on exogenous insulin therapy. And that was a turning point in the discovery of insulin to say, you know what? We can actually get blood sugars down by injecting this hormone called insulin. And that was in the year 1921. And by the year 1922, they were starting to ramp up production. They were going to the slaughterhouses to get the beef and the pork pancreases, and they were making insulin. And one of their patients was this little guy we saw in our first session. And he has type 1 diabetes, obvious by his loss of muscle mass. He has no fat. He's really wasting and failure to thrive. Without insulin, the growth hormone, you cannot sustain life. And so a lot of times patients say, you know, I don't want to go on insulin. And I just think of this little boy and all the children and people's lives who have been saved by insulin. And really, truly, what a miracle it is. Here's some of the first insulin that was available in 1922. It was being manufactured by Eli Lilly, and also University of Toronto was trying to make some because there was such an urgent worldwide need for it. So they were trying their best to meet with the demands. And it was a big production. And finally, they figured out a way to clean it because the first insulins were really kind of brown, mucky. And so Dr. Collip helped figure out a way to clean up the insulin so it didn't cause an abscess every time you injected it. Here's this little guy, J.L., December 15th, 1922. Here is the same little boy after receiving insulin therapy for 2 months. So you can see he's got chubby cheeks. I wouldn't say he looks a lot happier, but I'm sure his mother is a lot happier. And, of course, he has energy finally. He can run around and play with other kids. He can eat what he wants. And so really, receiving insulin therapy was revolutionary and transformative for these children, and that's why Banting and Best did win the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1923 for their discovery of insulin. He was actually the youngest person to receive the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine to this day. So World Diabetes Day is actually dedicated to Dr. Banting. It's on his birthday. While we're here, let me ask you all another question. A patient tells you she doesn't want to start insulin therapy. What is your best response? Patient tells you, I don't want to take insulin. What would we say to that patient? Thank you for voting, everybody. 100% of you have voted, and you guys are on fire today. Yeah, we're going to ask a patient to tell me why, because a lot of our patients Yeah, I just want to share this with all of you. 100% of you chose the correct answer. Thank you very much. A lot of patients are afraid of insulin because of needle, you know, the needle, or they're going to get addicted to it, or their Aunt Lucy went on insulin and she passed away. And so we want to find out their story. We want to hear from them. Tell me why you don't want to go on it. And generally, I've seen in my practice, and I'm sure it sounds like you all have had this experience too, when we listen to why they don't want to do it, as they talk through it, they become aware of maybe some of the mythology in their own thinking, especially as we explain it to them. And just the act of being heard helps people change their path. Like if you hear somebody and really witness what they're saying, many times they'll say, actually, I think I could go on insulin. They may not use those words obviously exactly, but you get that feeling from them. Lots of people are resistant to going on insulin because they were threatened by their provider. If you don't get your diabetes under control, you're going to have to go on insulin. And a lot of times providers don't really understand that the benefit of putting people on insulin as far as blood sugar improvement. And a lot of patients don't believe that insulin will really help them better manage their diabetes. So we want to find out the root and help them get past their fear. And here's a gentleman I just thought I'd share with you. He came into my office the other day and I go, you know, he's on insulin. I go, well, how do you carry your insulin around? And he had this amazing tackle box he bought from Walmart or somewhere like that for $5 and had all of it, you know, totally tricked out. So I just said, can I take your picture? This is so amazing. So you, when you look at this gentleman, you know that he is connected with his diabetes. You know he is checking his blood sugar, taking his insulin. He's actively involved, even if he said nothing to you. You can clearly see this patient is really trying their best. And actually, that patient was really struggling with blood sugars, and we'll talk about how we adjusted his insulin later, you know, a similar patient to him. The other thing I really want to point out is needle size does matter. And I've listed here the original BD insulin needles, and then here's short, here's mini, and then ultra mini. So the short needles work just fine. It's the bottom line. Even if patients are very obese, we can use the short mini needles because insulin is a subcutaneous injection. It goes into the fat. And so the studies have shown it works. If your patients ever say to you, well, there's a little bit of fluid after I inject on my skin, just tell them hold the insulin needle in for 5 to 10 seconds, and that should help the insulin be absorbed into their fat. So here it says, if to avoid leakage, count to 10. Half the patients who could benefit from insulin are not using it due to needle phobia. So if we can get them on insulin pens, if their insurance covers it, or shorter needles, it can make a real difference. Okay, so let's get down to here the nitty-gritty of insulin. What's happening as far as insulin in our body? And really what I want to say to you is that we want to think like a pancreas, or we want to think, what would the pancreas be doing right now? And that's our ultimate job when we're helping patients figure out insulin therapy, is to imitate the work of the pancreas through injections. So we're not, it's difficult to do exactly right, but we can approximate what the pancreas would be doing. So let's just take a look at that. So when I eat food, my blood sugars go up. So you can tell this person doesn't have diabetes because they eat a meal and their blood sugars never go above 140. So their pancreas is able to make enough insulin to prevent that blood sugar from going higher than 140. So you know after you eat a meal, your blood sugar should stay less than 140. That's the, you know, for people without diabetes with a normal functioning pancreas, that's what we expect. We expect the pancreas to keep that post-meal blood sugar less than 140. And then we have different targets for people with diabetes we'll talk about in a minute. But anyway, so the pancreas realizes that, hey, blood sugars are rising. The pancreas is getting surrounded by glucose from food that we've just eaten. So it releases this bolus insulin to help move the glucose from the meal we ate into our muscle and into our liver, and extra is stored as fat. So if you look at your insulin pocket card, and I've separated out the insulins between bolus and basal. So if you look, you could see there's four different bolus insulins. There's aspart, lispro, glycine, and those are all called analogs. So those three start working very quickly within 5 minutes, 5 to 15 minutes. Those are the ones made from recombinant DNA therapy, very similar to our own insulin. The other one is regular. So regular has been around for a long time, since the 1920s, and it starts working in 30 to 60 minutes. So it has a little bit of a lag, but it still does the same thing. It's a bolus insulin designed to get those blood sugars down associated with food. So normally my pancreas would release a dose of insulin because my blood sugars are on the rise. But with diabetes, as you know, that doesn't happen. The pancreas might make, if you have type 2 diabetes, it makes less, it's delayed in making it, and if you have type 1, it makes none. So we have to imitate that with bolus insulins. Those are the insulins we give with meals, oftentimes called prandial insulin. Okay, so look at this person, mealtime glucose at lunch, they didn't eat that much, so the pancreas just responded like that. And here, dinner time, a little bit more, so the pancreas had to generate a little bit more insulin. Okay, but what about in between meals and through the night? We have something called basal glucose. So that is the glucose needed to be in our blood for our brain to function, for our body to function. And normally, fasting, that's less than 99. So normal fasting blood sugar less than 99. How does our blood sugar stay at such a precise range? Well, basal insulin. Basal insulin is released throughout the day and the night, and approximately 0.5 units an hour of basal insulin is released from our pancreas. It just squirts out a little bit of basal insulin throughout the day. And this basal insulin's job is to keep blood sugars in control between meals and through the night. Basal insulin really is responsible for getting our fasting blood sugar to target. You see, this is really important because basal insulin tells our liver to stop releasing sugar. Without that insulin being released throughout the night, the liver releases extra glucose. And that's why many people with type 2 diabetes have high fasting blood sugars. They don't make enough basal insulin. Okay, so look at your insulin pocket card, and you'll see we have three basal insulins currently. We have NPH. So NPH is considered intermediate acting. You have to take it twice a day. And then we have the long-acting versions, and these are analogs, the Dedamir and the Glargine. So those are once a day injections. They last for 24 hours, but as we'll talk about later, some people may be taking them twice a day because it seems like they don't get enough coverage taking it once a day. But they really are designed to be taken once a day. Okay, so the main thing I want to say is we want to think like a pancreas. The pancreas, when we eat food, squirts out bolus insulin. We imitate that with bolus insulin injections. And between meals and through the night, our pancreas releases a little bit of basal insulin to keep blood sugars at target. So I call these the insulin action teams. The bolus insulin is a rabbit. It gets in there, does its job, hops back out. So bolus insulin is kind of done doing its thing within 4 hours usually. But basal insulin, not in any particular rush. It's kind of like the turtle. Kind of gets in there slow, hangs out for a day, and then walks on out. And again, I'm just kind of repeating key points here. Bolus insulins are that covering the glucose coming in from food, and also if you're hyperglycemic, maybe you're in a stress state, you release extra bolus insulin. And it should really comprise about half of your total daily dose. So if I have a patient who comes in and they're on 100 units of insulin a day, 50% of that, or 50 units, should be bolus insulin. So when we look at, that's a really important thing to keep in mind during this presentation, is that when we first start working with our patients, the first thing I do is look to see how much insulin they're on and what percent is basal, what percent is bolus. And it should be about 50-50. 60-40 is okay too, but if it's way off from that, we're going to make some changes and suggest some changes to the provider. The thing about regular insulin is that we want to take it 30 minutes before the meal. And so that offers a little bit of problems for some patients because they may not know what they're going to eat 30 minutes from now. That's why these insulins, the analogs, are so popular, because you can inject and then eat almost immediately. Despite the valiant efforts of the research group, the insulin suppository had one major problem. So it's just kind of a, you know, humorous depiction of what we're trying to do, and that is figure out a different way to give insulin besides injections. And I'm very excited to say that inhaled insulin, known as Afrezza, was approved earlier this year, 2014. Now, it was approved for only adults, not indicated for pregnancy or while breastfeeding. And you can see here's insulin lispro. Here's the curve for insulin lispro with an injection of insulin. And here's the Afrezza. So you can see the Afrezza gets in very quickly. And then it has a little bit of a shorter half-life. So you inhale it into the lungs. The pH of the lungs activates the insulin. And then the blood sugars respond accordingly. And so it gets in there really fast, which is a benefit. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Afrezza more throughout this program. But I do want to say all that Afrezza is regular insulin in powdered form. They powdered it using this Technosphere technology. And it's referred to, when you read it about it in papers, they call it T1, which means Technosphere insulin. Regular insulin packaged up in a powder that's small enough to be absorbed in the alveoli of your lungs. Really exciting. Is it going to be expensive? Yeah. Any new medication is really expensive, but what they're saying, the marketing, is that it won't be any more expensive than insulin pens. So now it's just getting the insurance companies on board to cover that. Afrezza dosing and consideration. You know what? It's the same dosing as a conversion of 1-to-1 ratio with existing insulin dose. Here's the issue, though. It's a bolus insulin, so you still would need the long-acting basal insulin. You inhale it before meals. The dosing is in 4- and 8-unit cartridges. So there's not a 1-unit, 2-unit, 3-unit cartridge. No, it's only 4 and 8 units. And so what if I have type 1 diabetes and I usually take, 3 units before a meal? Well, I would have to take 4. Or what if I usually take 6 units? Well, I'd have to take 8. So this may not work for patients who are very insulin sensitive, our type 1s who are leaner, but for our type 2s, they're less insulin sensitive, and I think they can do very well with this insulin dosing strategy. But since it is inhaled through the lungs, it is not indicated for patients with chronic lung issues, asthma, COPD, lung cancer, smokers, because there is a black box warning that it can cause acute bronchospasm. And before a patient starts on Afrezza, we have to do a forced expiratory volume testing. So it's a lung function test. It can be done in the office to make sure that they have normal lung function or within a certain range. The side effects include, just like regular insulin, low blood sugar, but also sore throat and cough. So some patients do complain of that. But there is less hypoglycemia and weight gain than injected insulin, so definitely has some benefits. I do want to say that when they looked at the lung function of patients on Afrezza, there was a little bit of a drop in lung function over the first 3 months, then it stabilizes, and then if they stopped the Afrezza, their lung function went back to normal. But the lung function diminishment didn't affect their breathing in any way. The patients didn't notice it. But it's just an observation that is out there. So that's why we have to monitor their lung function at baseline every 6 months and yearly. If the FEV declines more than 20%, we might have to stop it. They didn't test it on smokers, and if the patient's on albuterol, probably not a good idea for them to be on this because they probably have some asthma, but it did enhance the absorption. I wanted to show you the inhaler. It's so amazing because it's such a small device, the size of a whistle, really. I mean, really compact. They worked hard on getting this device to be accurate, reliable, and to be small. There wasn't another insulin released maybe a decade ago called Exubera, but the device was so large that it was cumbersome for people to use. So we're hoping this will make it a little more achievable for people to succeed. So all you have to do, here's the insulin cartridge right here. It's a 4 or 8 unit. Here's the insulin cup. You open the device, you put the cup in, you snap it closed, and then you inhale. You replace the inhaler every 15 days and don't wash it. So here's the 2 strengths of Afrezza. They have color-coded it. The 4 units come in blue and 8 units is a green cartridge. The other thing is you want to let the insulin cartridges and inhaler sit at room temperature for 10 minutes before using, because it's in a powder and when it's cold, it doesn't absorb into the lungs as well. So getting it to room temperature is another important step. And then once you actually get the cartridge in, you hold the inhaler. Well, this is just showing how to put the cartridge in. We've already done that. So let me go to the actual inhalation of it. So first of all, you exhale and then position inhaler in the mouth. Make sure you take off the cover. And then you actually tilt the inhaler down. Inhale deeply and hold your breath for as long as comfortable. And then you're done. Remove cartridge and replace cover. So I think it really, I'm just going to go back for a second, has a lot of benefits to offer for our patients who have needle phobias, who want to break from injections. They would still need to take the Lantus insulin, but at least for meals, they could take this Afrezza. And Sanofi Aventis did purchase this insulin, and they're hoping to get it out and market it early 2015. So that is going to be exciting. I wanted you to know about it because it's approved, it's going to be available, and we want to kind of think about what patients would benefit from inhaled insulin, especially our type 2s who aren't as insulin sensitive. We're really great candidates for this different way of getting insulin in. Let's just take a look at this gentleman. He's a 70-year-old. He weighs 100 kilograms. He's has a history of a heart attack. He smokes cigarettes. Oh, my gosh. Look at his A1C, 11.3. His blood glucose has been running really high for the past few months. He's on 100 units of Lantus. So we talked about that earlier. Like, he's just on basal insulin. He's on oral medications and metformin and Invokana. What is a better insulin dosing strategy? And he can't afford insulin pens. So he's on the insulin pens. He can't afford it. What other options? So what I'd like to do now is launch a poll and ask you which insulins are cheapest. If you're working with patients who say, man, I can't afford my insulin, my Lantus, or my insulin pens, what could we recommend that they purchase that is less expensive for them? And where I work, I have a lot of patients who get in a donut hole, are working poor, older patients whose copay is so big they can't afford their insulins. And so we want to have a backup plan for them. Okay, I'm going to share the poll with you. You guys, I'm going to make these poll questions harder because you guys are getting them all right. But yes, regular and MPH insulins are the cheapest. Let me just show you. I did write a whole newsletter on this because I was feeling really frustrated. So many of my patients weren't taking their diabetes medications because they couldn't afford them. It's not the patient's fault. It's that we as advocates for them need to make sure that their regimen is affordable. And so what I did in my community is I called around and I just asked, hey, how much are your insulins? Walmart, Walgreens, and Costco. This is in my community. Your community might be different. But what we found is that Walmart has a Rely-On brand where regular insulin, MPH, and 70/30 are only $25 for a bottle. And a bottle is 1,000 units. And so this is a great piece of information to share with our patients. If you look at Humalog, even at Walmart, look at that, $200 if you're cash pay. Look at Levemir, also known as Dedemir, across the board, $300 for a vial. And so for patients with insurance, and the insurance covers this, that may not be an issue. But for patients who have a big copay, like for many of my patients, I'll tell them just buy the medications cash. It might be cheaper than your copay. We'll talk about oral medications next time, which ones of those are most affordable. So to kind of wrap up with bolus insulin, like I said, it's the rabbit, gets in there quick, gets out fast. How do we tell how well it's working? Well, the post-meal blood sugar reflects how well it worked. And it should be about half the total daily dose. It covers food or hyperglycemia. And just to give us one unit of measure to help us estimate how much a patient needs, one unit of insulin in general covers about 15 grams of carb. I have a range here, 10 to 15 grams, but for anybody kind of starting out on carbohydrate counting, we'll just say the ratio is 1 to 15. So I just had a patient come in to see me yesterday, And I was asking him, how much insulin do you take when you eat an apple? He's like, 1 unit. And then I was like, well, how much insulin do you take when you drink he has like vodka Collins or something. He goes, 1 unit. So his ratio is 1 unit for every 15 grams of carbohydrate. Very common. The other thing is 1 unit will lower your blood sugar. How much? That's a critical question. We'll go over that later again. But generally, if the patient is lean, we say 1 unit will drop your blood sugar about 50 points. If they're heavier, 1 unit might only drop their blood sugar 30 points. If they're very heavy, 1 unit may drop their blood sugar 10 points. So this is called insulin sensitivity. How much insulin does it take to lower your blood sugar? And generally, the leaner you are, the less insulin you need. Lean people are more insulin sensitive. Heavier people are more insulin resistant. They need more insulin. So insulin sensitivity is very relative to body weight. So if you walk into a really thin patient's room with 10 units of Humalog, they're going to tell you that's going to make me crash, right? I mean, it's just too much. If they're very thin and insulin sensitive, 10 units is too much. But if you walk into a morbidly obese patient's room with 2 units of insulin, Humalog or Novolog or regular, they're going to laugh. They're going to say, that's not going to touch me, because it probably won't, because insulin sensitivity is relative to body weight. Okay, so bolus insulin. How do we determine how effective it is? Well, we can look at the 2 hour post-meal. If you can get it, that's the caveat here. Because a lot of people, after they inject, they're busy, they're doing stuff, they don't, oftentimes it's difficult to get a 2 hour post-meal. We'll ask for it in pregnancy or type 1s on insulin pumps. So when we're doing more intensive therapy, we'll definitely try and get that. But generally, we rely on the before next meal blood glucose. So here's the goals we're looking for. If I check my blood, so suppose I give, regular insulin before breakfast, and I check my blood sugars 1 to 2 hours after the meal, the target is less than 180. If I give my Humalog before breakfast and I check before next meal, which would be lunch, before lunch, the target is 70 to 130. So that just helps patients gauge. I'll say, well, if you take your Humalog at breakfast and you don't check again till lunch, your pre-lunch target is 70 to 130. But if you take your Humalog at breakfast and you check 2 hours later, the target is less than 180. So that helps patients to know what are they working toward. Without targets, people can't succeed, and it's hard for us to make adjustments in their insulin. So targets are just really important. Okay, so this is my famous insulin sliding scale slide. And I want to talk about sliding scale for a minute because I know it's used, I've seen it used in the hospital, and I've seen it used on the outpatient side. And it is the least effective way to manage blood sugars. It's difficult for patients, and it doesn't help them achieve success in spite of a lot of work. So let's just take a look. This bolus insulin sliding scale says you start giving insulin at when the blood sugar is 150, you give 2 units for every 50 above 150. So for example, 150 to 200, I'd give 2 units, 200 to 250, I give 4 units and so forth. So let's just say the patient, we can make this patient inpatient or outpatient. It doesn't matter. I've seen it in both situations. So the blood sugar at breakfast is 94. The patient gets no insulin because the blood sugar does not exceed 150. So with a blood sugar of 94, but this patient is going to eat breakfast. And let's just say he's going to eat 45 grams of carbohydrate. So let's just think like a pancreas for a minute. If I'm going to eat 45 grams of carbohydrate, what would my pancreas do? Yes, it would squirt out insulin. How much? Well, let's just say my pancreas would squirt out 1 unit for every 15 grams. So if I'm going to eat 45 grams, it would squirt out 3 units. But I got no insulin, none, zero, zippo. So even without looking at the next blood sugar, I know my lunch is going to be high. And it is. My lunch blood sugar is 212. So 212 is above the target. The target for before lunch was 70 to 130. I'm now at 212. So the scale calls for 4 units of regular insulin. So I'm given 4 units of regular. And let's just say I ate 45 grams of carb. So for 45 grams of carb, I would have injected 1 unit for every 15 grams, so 3 units. plus a little bit extra for hyperglycemia. So 4 units was almost exactly right, almost what I needed. And we can tell that because look what happened to my dinner blood sugar. My dinner blood sugar came in at 148. Now the target for before dinner is 70 to 130. So I'm just a little bit higher than that target. But guess what? Since I'm below 150, I get no insulin, zero Zippo. Okay, so now I'm going to eat 60 grams of carb. You know, my dinner is my bigger meal of the day. If I'm going to eat 60 grams of carb, you all know how many units would I need? Well, 1 unit for every 15, and 60 grams is 4 servings. I should have received 4 units of insulin, but I received none. So now let's see what happens at bedtime. My blood sugar is 254. The target for bedtime blood sugar is less than 180. So bedtime blood sugar target less than 180, but if the patient's on insulin, we like it greater than 110. So 110 to 180 would be our target range. We're above that. And so here we get into the situation now where we're taking 6 units of regular at bedtime. That is dangerous. It is not recommended. This is not what we want to send a patient to bed with, is regular on board. Because as you remember, regular insulin works its hardest in 4 to 6 hours. When I am, you know, well, it has a duration of up to 6 hours. It's working its hardest in 2 to 4 hours. But it's working its hardest and doing its biggest majority of its job while I'm sleeping. So my blood sugar could get too low. And I just was working with a patient the other day who came in and was taking a Novolog at bedtime. I said, please, if you can, don't take Novolog at bedtime. If your blood sugars are high at night, you should take the fast-acting insulin or bolus insulin at dinner, right? Just imagine if I would have taken 4 units at dinner right here to cover that 60 grams of carb, my blood sugar at bedtime would have been perfect. It would have been on the money. It would have been awesome. And so, as diabetes educators and advocates, we're going to look at blood sugars like this and see, are we thinking like a pancreas, or is this a scale that doesn't make sense? And we can at least identify what's not working. And just like you could say to the provider, these blood sugars are above target. Can we make some changes? Or we'll talk about more specific things you might want to recommend to providers as we keep going. But let's just keep going on this example because I think it's really important. Okay, so here we gave him 6 units of regular at bedtime. Look what happened to his morning blood sugar. Holy mackerel, it's 243. So there's two things that could be happening here. One is that by giving him regular insulin at bedtime, his blood sugars went really low in the middle of the night. And that's something you've heard of called SMOGE or rebound hyperglycemia, where blood sugars go low, you release adrenaline and glucagon to get the blood sugars back up again. So maybe that happened. And that's why the blood sugars are high in the morning. That's one possibility. And to identify if patients have had nocturnal lows, you want to find out, do they get a headache in the morning? People who wake up with headaches in the morning who are on insulin, it's often a sign that they had a low blood sugar. Or they could have vivid dreams. So if they wake up and they say, I had the most vivid dream, it was in color, that could be a sign of nocturnal hypoglycemia. Or maybe they woke up in the middle of the night hungry, another sign. So the one situation could be the blood sugars got low and then the patient released glucagon and adrenaline to kick those blood sugars up, called rebound hyperglycemia. Or maybe we're just missing something, right? Are we thinking like a pancreas? No, we're just using regular insulin. So we don't have any long-acting. We have no basal insulin on board. Maybe it's just the liver squirting out sugar all night because the insulin ran out. We don't know which one it is, but we can ask the patient, hey, did you get any headaches last night or did you wake up hungry? So we can find out if they went low. But we need to fix this situation because let's keep looking at the rest of this pattern. This patient is, let's just put him outpatient, checking blood sugars 4 times a day, taking insulin 3 and 4 times a day. They should have great blood sugar control. If you look at this entire pattern, there's only one blood sugar that's at target, and that's here, breakfast, before we started this shenanigans. Because the target for before meals is 70 to 130. We've never achieved that. target at bedtime, 110 to 180. We've never achieved that. And I know you've seen patients in this situation. So during this webcast, we're going to learn strategies to fix this and make it better. But certainly we know that this is not working and we need to help make some changes. So this patient, you know, you might, some people might say, well, this patient's not compliant. Look at their blood sugars. They're all over the place. Well, it's nothing to do with the patient. It's that the plan isn't working. We haven't figured out the right insulin plan for this patient. And let's do that as we keep going. So let me do one more poll to ask you another question. Let me launch this. Elevated fasting blood glucose levels indicate a need for what? Do we need to give them more basal insulin, more bolus insulin, 70-30, maybe give some carbohydrates, or I'm not sure. Okay, take one more second. Thank you, everyone. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this. So we're going to talk now about basal insulins. And basal insulins are the insulins that, you know, work. There's intermediate acting and there's long acting. And how do we evaluate the efficacy of basal insulins? Well, the fasting blood sugar reflects the efficacy of basal. So to answer this poll question, if the patient's fasting blood sugar is too high, we know that we need to make adjustments in the basal insulin because basal insulin helps lower the morning blood sugar. And the morning blood sugar target is 70 to 130. You guys did a great job. Most of you got that right. The other thing I want to point out is that basal insulins should comprise half the total daily dose. So bolus is half the dose, basal is the other half. And as I've mentioned before, basal insulin, NPH, Levemir, and Lantus covers between meals through the night. It really, the newer ones, Levemir and Lantus, they say they're peakless. NPH does have a peak 4 to 10 hours. NPH lasts for about 12 hours, and the other ones, the Lantus and Levemir, last for 20 to 24 hours. And Lente is no longer with us, so I need to update my slide. But we look at the fasting blood sugar to reflect the efficacy. So let's take a look at another case study. And here's a patient with type 2 diabetes, 60 kilograms, his A1C is 8.7. And so what happens is that the patient goes in to see their provider, and the provider is very concerned about their blood sugars, which is terrific. And they say to that patient, let's start you on some Lantus. So Lantus is a very common starting insulin for people with diabetes, and it's the right place to start for most patients with type 2 diabetes. And so the provider says, well, let's start you on 10 units of Lantus. And you may say, well, where does that come from? It's a very common starting dose, 10 units. So we start there, and then you'll see over time that morning blood sugar is coming down. This is month one. It was 170. Month two, it's 160. We went up to 20 Lantus. By month three, we went up to 30 of Lantus, and the morning blood sugars are getting closer to target. So you can see when we get up to 40 of Lantus, we probably will be at target of blood sugars, 70 to 130 in the morning. But we have a problem, and that is the A1C is 8.7. So we started to ask the patient to check the blood sugars before lunch and before dinner, and holy mackerel, look what we see, that, yeah, their morning blood sugars are at target, but before lunch and dinner, which has a target of 70 to 130, are running above, way above target. And so this again tells us we better think like a pancreas. If the basal insulin is getting down the fasting, but the rest of the day is running high, what do we need to add? You are right. We need to add a bolus insulin. And so what are we going to do? We're going to get to some formulas, but I want to talk a little bit right now about insulin dosing strategy for type 1s and type 2s. So you can see for our type 1, if you look at their body weight and how many units of insulin per kilogram per day that they need, for type 1, they only need generally about 0.25 to 1 unit of insulin per kilogram per day. Because type 1s don't have insulin resistant, they're just insulin deficient. So type 1s, we're just replacing the insulin that they don't make. So we're not fighting insulin resistance. But let's take a look at type 2s. It says here they need about, I don't know, 0.5 to 2.25 insulin per kilogram per day. Why? Because type 2s are not only insulin deficient, they are also insulin resistant. So we have to fight not only the deficiency, we replace that, we also have to give extra insulin to fight the resistance. So how do you fight resistance? By giving more insulin, you can overcome the resistance. Of course, you guys are right. By losing weight and exercising too, that's really, really helpful. And then we have some patients, this is very rare, but who have very severe insulin resistance. We're not going to talk about them, but we are going to talk right now about our type 2s, because when we see a patient on more than 200 units a day, so you know that an insulin syringe, the max dose for a U100 syringe is 100 units. And so if you're on 200 units a day, you have to fill up two syringes and inject yourself. And for patients, it's psychologically difficult to give more than that, and it's usually hard to get their blood sugars under control. And so who goes on more than 200 units a day? It's mostly our very obese type 2s. And as you know, the weight of our country is increasing. Currently, 70% of our people are overweight or obese. And so our insulin needs are going to go up as we get heavier as a population. And so I just wanted to introduce a Humulin R, but this is called U500. U100 looks like this. U500 is a different looking bottle. It's thicker, it has red and white stripes like a barber shop, and it says U500 right on top. This is 20 milliliters. This is only 10. So this is high, it says right here, warning, high potency, not for ordinary use. So they're trying to let people know this is totally different. It's five times the strength of U100. Let's talk about it a little bit more. So U500 is five times potent. If you were to take a bottle of U100 and pull it up in your typical U100 syringe, that's just your usual syringe you would use for U100 insulin. If you drew up one unit of U500, that would equal 5 units of insulin. And so it's five times the strength. If I drew up 5 units of U500 and a U100 syringe, that would be 25 units. I know that's kind of confusing, so I hope that makes sense. I have a chart on the next page I'm going to show you. So this is concentrated, highly concentrated insulin, five times the concentration of U100. Here's the great thing about it, is that U500 is regular insulin, more concentrated, but it has the qualities of both basal and bolus insulin. So if you take U500, you just have to take it, many patients take it twice a day. They take 60% in the morning and 40% before dinner because it has an immediate effect plus a long-lasting effect. So it combines the basal bolus in that one insulin. So it is oftentimes easier for patients to use. But it is, we have to proceed with caution because it is has more risk of hypoglycemia. So many times in hospitals, they don't draw it up into an insulin syringe. They use a tuberculin syringe to really make it clear that this is a different type of insulin. So there's 500 units per milliliter, and there's 20 units in a vial of U500. So there's 10,000 units per vial. There's a lot of insulin in that U500. The cost is $400 a vial, so that is very expensive. But it seems to be, with the studies they've done, as cost-effective as buying U100, because you would need five times the amount of U100 to make one of the bottles of U500. So it seems to be, generally speaking, as economical as buying all of that insulin, and patients actually get a lot better control. Just think, if I was taking 100 units of insulin a day, you know, with U100, if I went to U500, that would be 20 units. You see what I'm saying, how different that is? If I just inject 20 units of U500, you know, twice a day, that would give me the same benefit as 100 of the usual strength. Needs careful monitoring and education. And here's a slide that I was showing you that if This is your dose of U500. This is what you would fill up a U100 syringe to, and this is what you would fill a tuberculin syringe to. So this kind of just helps us orient to the different volumes required. So tuberculin syringes are marked by volume, and insulin syringes are marked by this U100, dosing. And so you can use either one, but here's a chart that would help you. Look, if you're going to take 425 units of insulin, it just equals 85 units of the U500. So it's so much more concentrated than you take a lot less insulin to get the same effect, and people really have a lot of benefit from that. So in your resource section, I have put a lot of information on U500 insulin that you can read. There's several articles on it, and if you have any other questions, let me know, and we can talk about it next time. Or you can email me in between. That would be great too. Okay, so remember, let's go back now to our patient, and we want to think like a pancreas. So how do we think like a pancreas? And there's different strategies to get to the right dose. And I do want to point out to you one of my favorite algorithms for starting insulin, and this came out of Diabetes Care 2009. So it's a little bit old, but I think it's really good because it's simple, it's straightforward, and it gives us information that we need. So let's just take a look at it. So if I have a new type 2, maybe they come in and they're on a lot of basal insulin and their blood sugars are high. How do I figure out how much insulin they need? And this algorithm gives us really good information on it. And that is, we're going to start with bedtime intermediate acting insulin, or bedtime or morning long acting. So what that means is we're going to start with, MPH or Lantus or Denimer. And look what it says here, start with 10 units or 0.2 units per kilogram, but let's just say 10 units. So now we start them on 10 units, the basal insulin, a very common starting point. And then we check the fasting glucose daily. And we increase the dose typically by every 2 units every 3 days until fasting levels are in target, 70 to 130. So if you have a provider you're working with or a group of providers, you could fax them this sheet and show them the article and say, dear provider, with your permission, I'd like to use this algorithm to help adjust insulins. I'll let you know everything I'm doing, but I'm going to use this as a framework. That might be a nice conversation point with your providers, because this is from, Diabetes Care. It's ADA recognized, and I think it's just very solid in its presentation and it's realistic. Look at this. Can increase dose in larger increments, 4 units every 3 days, if fasting blood sugar is more than 180. So I always proceed with caution. I'm very conservative when I suggest increases because I always want to prevent hypo. And that's just take a look at hypo here. It says if hypoglycemia occurs or fasting glucose level is less than 70, this is so important. Reduce bedtime dose by 4 units or 10%, whichever is greater. This is just such an important number to keep in mind. If the fasting blood sugar is less than 70, reduce the basal by 4 units or 10%, whichever is greater. This is just, you want to memorize that for life because I've used that so many times in my own practice. When those blood sugars are low, I'm really going to cut back on the basal insulin because morning blood sugars, when they're too low, can lead to nocturnal hypoglycemia, which is dangerous. Okay, so let's say we start the patient on the basal, and then the blood sugars finally fasting get to target range, but that A1C is still up. Now what do we do? If fasting blood sugar is target, then we want to check blood glucose before dinner, lunch, and bed. Depending on blood glucose results, add a second injection as below. Look at this. Can usually begin with 4 units of bolus and adjust. So listen to this. So we talked about in that one case study that gentleman was going to eat 60 grams of carbohydrate. For 60 grams of carbohydrate, he needed 4 units of insulin. Look at this. And that's a very common amount of carbohydrates people eat per meal, 45 to 60 grams approximately. So 4 units is kind of based on that. People eat about that much per meal. They need about 4 units of insulin to cover that meal. Okay, so let's keep going. But it says here, if pre-lunch blood sugar is out of range, add rapid acting at breakfast. So let's just step away from this for a minute. So I'm checking my blood sugars during the day, and my fasting is okay because I'm on enough basal insulin, but before lunch is too high. My target for before lunch is 70 to 130, but let's say I'm running 180. So that tells us I need bolus insulin at breakfast. If I take bolus insulin at breakfast, it's going to help get my before lunch blood sugar to target. Okay, let's do another one. Let's say my before dinner blood sugar is too high. When would I need to add bolus insulin? Before dinner blood sugar is too high. Exactly. I would need to add bolus insulin before lunch. What if my bedtime is too high? When would I need to add bolus insulin? Exactly, before dinner. So this is how we think like a pancreas. So many times patients go on Lantus, but I've seen them, their blood sugars go very high before lunch because their breakfast, they had a lot of carbohydrates. So we give them that bolus insulin before breakfast. And many times I'll see their blood sugars go high before they go to bed. So we give them some bolus insulin before dinner. Does that make sense? Good. And it's about 4 units is a starting point. Okay, so what if a patient comes in and they're already on insulin? Well, you can use this to see how close it matches. It gives you some feedback to see where are they in relationship to this formula. And there's also another formula here, the ACE algorithm. And if you do plan to take the CDE exam, this comes up on the exam. They talk about the ACE algorithms for medications and insulin. But it's really saying a very similar thing. They say start basal insulin and they say about 10 units or they do total daily insulin just like that last formula, which is 0.2, about 2 units per insulin per kilogram per day. And then you increase this to get the blood sugar to target. And it gives you suggestions on how to increase it. If the fasting blood sugar is more than 180, add 4 units. And if it's here, add 2 units to the basal insulin. But then it says if the glycemic control not at goal, we're going to intensify and add prandial insulin, which means bolus insulin. And again, it talks about the ratio, 50% basal, 50% bolus. It also says you can add some oral medications, which we'll talk about next time. So this kind of says the same thing in a different format. And let's just take a look at a case study in a few minutes where we can apply these concepts. But before I go to the case study, I do want to say a few things. Both of these articles are in your resource section. So if you're kind of new to insulin and you want to get some great information, I would download these and read this information, which will help expand your knowledge of insulin management and help you feel more confident with it. And then we'll do some case studies to apply this. The other thing I do want to talk about are pre-mixed insulins. Here's 75-25. When you see an insulin with a ratio like this, 70-30, 50-50, all it means is that they're mixing together a long-acting or a basal insulin, the first one, plus a bolus insulin. The first number represents the percentage of long-acting insulin. The second number represents a percentage of short-acting insulin. So in Humalog 75-25, it's 75% NPL. What is NPL? Long-acting lispro and 25% lispro, the bolus insulin. 70-30, for example, is 70% MPH and 30% regular. So these premixed insulins, and as I mentioned, a bottle of 70-30 is only $25 at Walmart. Combine bolus plus basal. Who do I use this for? Well, I like using 70-30 for anybody newly started on insulin who's running in the 300s. So if I have a patient come in to me, and they have type 2 diabetes, they're running 300s, and they really need insulin therapy, and I want to keep it easy, we'll start on something like this. 10 units of 70-30 twice a day. Take an injection at breakfast, take an injection before dinner. And it just gets them out of their hyperglycemic crisis. That's the number one thing I want to do. It gets them out of the 300s to the 200s. And then we can increase it over time. And then when they get their blood sugars close to target, we can intensify their therapy, but for a lot of patients, especially those on a budget or those who they're just overwhelmed with their diabetes, I want to keep it as simple as possible so they can realistically incorporate it into their life. Okay, so let's just take a look. This patient's on 10 units of 70/30, so that means it's 70% basal, 30% bolus. So if it's 10 units, I know it's 7 units of NPH and 30 units of regular. So I just kind of translate it like that in my mind. Now we're going to take a look at patterns. And so I want to just do a poll with you. When you're looking at glucose patterns, which problem do you fix first? Do you fix hyperglycemia first, hypoglycemia? Do you tackle noncompliance, or do you make sure they're writing neatly and their logbooks? Which problem, when you look at glucose patterns, do you want to address first with your patient? Okay, we have two answers running neck and neck, but one did win out. I'm going to close this and share this with all of you. And that is hypoglycemia is the right answer, and 67% of you chose that. You're right. When we're working with patients on insulin, we want to protect them against low blood sugar because low blood sugar can lead to severe consequences. So the first thing when we look at patterns is we want to identify when they're running low. And let's just take a look here with this patient. Breakfast, the target is 70 to 130. They're 100% of the time in that target. Before lunch, the target is 70 to 130. They only made that target once. Let's just take a look at dinner. Before dinner, the target is 70 to 130. They're hanging in there most of the time. We had a 132. Oops, sorry. At bedtime, the target is less than 180, but more than 110. Oops, dinner is a little bit higher than we'd like to see. So our biggest issue, though, is our lunch being too low. A 56 at lunch is very dangerous. That's, you know, to the place where that patient may not be able to figure out how to get the blood sugar up. They may be too low to think clearly. And so we really want to help people avoid that. If they're on 10 units of 70/30 at breakfast, we know it's that insulin, the 3 units of regular that's in that 70/30, that's making that lunch blood sugar go too low. So how do we fix that? So here we are, we're talking to this patient, and we notice that their blood sugar is below 70 at lunch, and this is an urgent situation. So we call the provider, we fax the provider, however you communicate with your providers, and you say, "Doc, I'm really worried. You know, blood sugars at lunch are running below 70. Can we do what?" And so maybe you have prescriptive authority. You can make the change right away. That's great. But if not, we're going to call the provider and say, "Can we decrease the 70/30? So what would you all suggest we decrease it to? He's on 10 units. Yeah, I would definitely say eight units would be sufficient. And maybe if the patient tells you, "Gosh, you know what, I'm just really trying to eat more because I keep getting low," maybe he's really overdosed on insulin. We could go to 6, you know, so it depends on the patient. But I would just start, let's start with 8 units of 70/30 in the morning and see if we can't get that lunch blood sugar above 70 consistently. That's the first thing we're going to do. So we're going to call the provider and let them know that we'd like to make that change. And if we can't get a hold of the provider, I would say to the patient, and just, you know, let the provider know that we're wanting to change this. And if you can't get a hold of them by the morning, I would go ahead and just take the 8 units just for safety's sake. That's very reasonable to do to help prevent low blood sugar at lunch. Okay, so we fix that, so usually if we fix one thing, we let it sit for a few days before we make a fix for a second thing. But let's take a look at this bedtime blood sugar. The target is less than 180, and we're running a little bit above that. So you could say, "Well, Bev, let's increase the 70/30 at dinner time." But if we increase the 70/30 at dinner time, we will get this bedtime blood sugar down, but because there's 7 units of long-acting in there, we'll get that morning down too. And actually, the morning's right where it needs to be. We don't want to make the morning blood sugar get any lower. So in this situation, increasing the 70/30 is not the right answer. Is there a different strategy we could use to get that bedtime blood sugar down besides increasing insulin? All right. You're right. I can hear it. We can tell the patient to take a walk after dinner. So lots of times I'll look at patterns and I'll go, you know what? I see that you're running a, I don't say high, I say above target at bedtime. Do you think you could take a walk after dinner, even a 10-minute walk? Let's experiment and see if you walk after dinner, if we can't get that blood sugar down to target, a less than 180. And that's a real motivation for patients because I'll say, you know, exercise is like taking 2 units of insulin. I think I've mentioned this before, but it's my favorite thing lately. So I'm going to mention it a lot probably. Anyway, so if that patient says, well, I could try that, I'll go, great, let's see what your blood sugars do. So that's one strategy. Get up and move around 10, 15 minutes after dinner or even longer if they can. The other strategy is just take a look at how much carbohydrate they eat at dinner time. Maybe if they cut back a little bit on their carbs at dinner, their bedtime blood sugar would be better. How much would they have to cut back? Not that much. Like if they're eating 2 pieces of bread and some peas and milk, you know, maybe just cut out a piece of bread or eat less of the peas or just something, you know, just negotiate with them. Hey, let's just experiment and see if you eat less at this time, if we can't get those blood sugars down at dinner. And this is really where having a referral to the dietitian is going to make a big difference with these blood sugars too. Okay, let's keep going. So we've talked about pattern management, and what the main thing is here, safety first. We want to look at 3-day patterns. We want to look at hypoglycemia first and fix that. And I do say here, if possible, decrease medication dose. So if a patient keeps getting low blood sugars, I don't want them to eat to feed the low blood sugar. I don't want them to say, wow, I kept getting low between breakfast and lunch, so I was eating snacks, because that's going to cause weight gain. And so we want to decrease the insulin to give them the least amount they need to get to target. And then we look at hyperglycemia second. Before we increase insulin, make sure we're not missing something else. Carbs, exercise, maybe they're skipping their insulin. Who knows? There's all kinds of stuff people, you know, do. They're just trying their best with their diabetes. So let's take another look at this. We have a patient, type 2 diabetes on Amaryl 4 milligrams. What is Amaryl? Well, if you look at your oral diabetes medication pocket cards, or maybe you're familiar with this class of medication, they're called sulfonylureas, and sulfonylureas stimulate the pancreas to make insulin. So these medications tell the pancreas to squirt out insulin all day long, really. Amaryl is a long-acting sulfonylurea. This patient is also on Lantus at night. So let's take a look. We're going to identify patterns. The target for before breakfast, 70 to 130. We never make that target. The target at lunch, 70 to 130. We make that all the time, 100% success. Target at dinner, 70 to 130. Wow, we made that once, and the other time's too low. Target at bedtime, less than 180. Yeah, kind of all over the map here, 50% of the time. Well, I'm sorry, 25%. We just had one in target range. Okay, so what's the thing we fix first? Exactly, we fix hypoglycemia first. So what we're going to do is look at this dinner blood sugar. So this pre-dinner blood sugar is too low. What is causing it to go too low? Is it the Amaryl or is it the Lantus? What do you all think? Well, I think you've got it right. It's the Amaryl. Because Lantus given at night just works for about 24 hours, so it's really running out by dinner time. The culprit here is the Amaryl. Amaryl is too much for this patient, and they're getting low at dinner. And as a matter of fact, they're getting so low at dinner, they're overeating carbs at dinner. And that's why I think their bedtime is high, because they're so nervous and worried about low blood sugar. And when you have low blood sugar, I'm sure you've experienced this, that you just want to eat a lot. And so they're eating to get that blood sugar back up. So the culprit here is the Amaryl. And so what we're going to do is call the provider. You know, I'm really concerned those blood sugars are running too low at dinner time. Could we do what to the Amaryl? So you could say, you know, can we decrease the Amaryl? Or I would just say cut it in half. Can we just give 2 milligrams and see what happens to those dinner time blood sugars? And then we let that sit for a few days, and then we start problem solving on the other stuff. We fix low first, let it sit, get back to baseline, and then we can start tackling that high blood sugar. And I think by getting this dinner blood sugar to target, they're not going to overeat and bedtime will come back to the right range. And then we could start working on getting this fasting blood sugar to target. And we actually might end up increasing the lantus a little bit, but that would be step two. Okay, so now we're going to get a chance to use some of the formulas I've talked about. And this is basal bolus, what adjustments? This patient weighs 80 kilograms and he has type 2 diabetes. And let's just take a look at his insulin. So the H stands for Humalog. He's on 7 units of Humalog at breakfast, 5 units of Humalog at lunch, 8 units of Humalog at dinner, and 22 units of DET, which stands for Denimer. It's a basal insulin at bedtime. So every day he takes the same, 7 in the morning, 5 at lunch, 8 at dinner, and 22 at bedtime. Okay, so now we know what he does now. Let's just take a look at what his blood sugars are doing. Target for before breakfast, 70 to 130. Wow, we have a 69 and a 62. I'm nervous. I'm very nervous. I don't like low blood sugars in the morning because remember I was talking about nocturnal lows. So let's take a look at lunch. Target 70 to 130. We're 100% in target. We're on the low end, but it's okay. We're going to keep an eye on that. How about dinner? Dinner, 70 to 130 is a target. We never make it. We're on the high end. And let's just take a look at bedtime. So bedtime is, well, we had, actually there's three in target, right? 110 to 180 and one out of target. So what's our biggest concern of the day? Breakfast. Breakfast is too low. We have a 69 and a 62. And so we know what insulin we have to change. It's the Denimer, right? It's a basal insulin affects morning blood sugar. So how much do we decrease the Denimer by? Do you remember that? 4 units or 10%, whatever greater. So we're going to call the provider and say, hi, provider, I'm really worried. Blood sugars in the morning are low. Can we decrease the Denimer to 18? Provider's going to say, thank you so much for contacting me. They're very appreciative, my providers. My imaginary providers are very appreciative. But in real life, too, they are, because managing diabetes is a lot of work and attention to detail. And that's what diabetes educators do. We have that hour consultation and the ongoing follow-up where we can help patients make these adjustments. Okay, so we decreased it to 18. We got that morning blood sugar up. Lunch is okay. And then dinner is high. But here's the question we really want to ask the patient. Where did you get this insulin dose of 7 of Humalog, 5 and 8? And you never adjust it. And I did ask the patient this. And he said, well, I made it up. Have you ever had patients say that? And I said, really? When's the last time you saw your diabetes doctor or provider? Well, I had a doctor help me with my diabetes about 10 years ago, and he gave me a dose, and it stopped working, so I adjusted it myself. And I understand that. I understand how people want to adjust themselves, and they want to take control. I really appreciate that they do that. But you can see this plan isn't working that well, so we're going to just coach him to success. And here's a formula that we talked about earlier. Now we're going to see it in real life, and it's called the 50-50 rule. And what it says is that people with diabetes need about 0.5 to 1 unit of insulin per kilogram per day. Half of that is basal, and the other half is bolus. Let's take a look at what that means in an example. So if I weighed 50 kilograms, I need about 0.5 units of insulin a day. That equals about 25 units of insulin a day. But I don't just give that in one big chunk. I give half of it as a basal dose, which is 13 units, because you can't do 12.5. So we just go up on the basal to 13. And the other half is my bolus dose, 12 units. So 13 plus 12 is 25. And so you can see this is a 50-50 ratio, 50% basal, 50% bolus. So I have 12 units of bolus, but I can't actually just take that all in one meal. I divide it by 3 meals. So that would be 4 units at every meal. Now, this might start ringing some bells, because remember that ADA algorithm I showed you where you start with 4 units at every meal? It's kind of based on this. So that 4 units during meals and about 10 units of lantus or glargine is a very kind of common starting point. Let's just try another one. What if I weighed 60 kilograms? How much insulin would I need a day? Well, we take 60 times 0.5 equals what? 30. And so what's half of 30? 15. So my basal dose would be 15 units, and that might be, you know, glargine or lantus once a day, or I might do denimer MPH twice a day. But I know I need 15 units to come from basal or long-acting insulin, and the other 15 units is bolus. Okay, so and the bolus dose of 15 I divide by 3 meals, so that's 5 units per meal. So you can see the heavier I am, the more I weigh, the more insulin I need. Insulin dose is relative to body weight. The leaner I am, the less I need. Okay, so let's take a look at this patient we were just looking at. He weighs 80 kilograms. So let's just do a quick calculation in our head. If I weigh 80 kilograms times 0.5, I need 40 units a day. Half of 40 is 20. That's my basal dose. And that's what they started him on. They just changed it a little bit. 20 units of denimer. And then I have, so 80 kilograms times 0.5 is 40 units, so 20 of that, or half, is basal. The other 20 is my bolus. So I divide 20 into 3 meals. So 20 doesn't go evenly into 3 meals, but we decided to give a little bit less at breakfast. He ate less at breakfast, and a little bit more at lunch and dinner. So 6 plus 7 plus 7 is 20 units right there. So let's take a look now at the blood sugars and see, by making that very simple minor adjustment, do we have an improvement in our blood sugars? Well, the target for before breakfast, 70 to 130. I want to point out something about breakfast. Day 1, 84. Day 2, 81. Day 3, 79. Day 4, 69. That's another way of looking at patterns, that every day, sequential day, he's getting lower. So if I see that happening, like each day it's getting lower and lower, it tells me on day 5, it's going to be even lower. So we're going to have to fix an insulin because he's getting too much of it. What insulin is that? You're right, the denimer. So even though we use this formula, even the formula needs tweaking, because once we get to what I call the sweet spot of insulin, many times you can cut back even more on the insulin. So we know that he's getting too low at in the breakfast time. We can decrease this denimer to what? How much will we decrease it by? 4 units or 10%, what's ever greater. 10% of 20 is 2.2. So we're going to crank it down to by 4 to 16 units. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we got the breakfast fixed. That's really important. And then how's lunch? 70 to 130 is a target, 100%. 70 to 130 at dinner. Okay, we have some outliers here. We have a 145 and a 208. So when we see that, that is not a pattern. That is just a blip in the screen. And so this, to me, this 208 is an office party at lunch. That's what I see. So we're going to say, hey, what did you eat at lunch? Was there a party? You know, and this is, when I see these types of numbers, it's a moment for us to problem solve, to say, I really appreciate you checking your blood sugars 4 times a day and writing it down. This is amazing. And I'm going to tell you why it's so amazing, because we can see patterns now. And we can see here on day 4, you know, you had a 69, 103, and then it went to 208. What do you think happened at lunch to make it go to 208? So this is a way that we can investigate, I would call it collaboration and investigation. And by finding out what happened at lunch, the patient understands more about their diabetes. It's really such an exciting process. So I just saw a patient yesterday, and he has a meter, and he checks his blood sugar 6 times a day. And I say, well, do you keep a log? He's like, well, no, it's in my meter. And I'm like, okay, the importance of a log is so we can see patterns, so you can help problem solve what's working and what's not working. So many patients, maybe for a week, I'll have them, you know, write down a logbook, we'll identify patterns and make some changes, and then they could take a break again. And so, you know, diabetes does last a long time, so we want to make it realistic for our people, what they can do. Okay, but anyways, so this, when we see numbers like this 145 or 208, we're just going to problem solve. Now, again, bedtime, we had a 190 and a 193 here. So we're just going to say, hey, what happened at dinner? Or maybe you could take a walk. We're just going to approach it from different angles to see how to improve that blood sugar. But you can see, this same patient, we just adjusted his insulin a little bit. By using that formula and making those adjustments, His blood sugars improved dramatically. And that's what we do as educators. We help make those fine tunings so that patients can feel like they're succeeding. Let's just wrap up talking a little bit more about bolus basics. So we know that bolus insulin, the regular Humalog, Novolog, Apidra, are to help cover for carbohydrates and to target hyperglycemia. And we've talked about this a lot, that one unit covers about 15 grams of carb, very common starting point. And the correction bolus, one unit covers 30 to 50 points over target. So we have the prandial or carbohydrate coverage, so that covers food, plus we have correction or hyperglycemia bolus or supplemental scale that covers hyperglycemia. So let's just take a look at this patient. She takes one unit for every 15 grams of carbohydrate, and she's going to have lemon chicken. So lemon chicken is a protein. It doesn't have any carbohydrate, but this one cup of rice pilaf is 45 grams. So for that 45 grams, she's going to look at her chart and know, I need 3 units of insulin. Asparagus is considered a free food for her, and the dinner roll is 15 grams, so that's one unit. So total for this meal is 4 units to cover carbohydrates, but we notice her blood sugar is 165. So she's not only going to cover for the carbohydrate, she also has to correct for hyperglycemia. And so when patients are adjusting and covering for food before meals, they're going to ask themselves 3 questions. How much am I going to eat? How much carbs? What is my insulin dose? And should I lower the dose because I plan to be very active or have recently been active? Because as you know, exercise moves glucose into the muscle, and so they might need a little bit less. So they're going to look at how much carb and their activity level and how much insulin. So that gal had a blood sugar, was it 165, I believe. So she has a correction scale that says, in addition to your carbohydrate coverage, you take 1 unit for every 50 above 150. So she's going to take 4 units for her rice plus her dinner roll plus 1 unit to cover for hyperglycemia for a total dose of 5 units. So let's just take a look at Cindy. Cindy here is trying to carb count and adjust her insulin. She has type 1 diabetes. She weighs 60 kilograms. So let's just do a quick calculation in our head. 60 kilograms, and we know she needs about 0.5 units of insulin per day. So 60 times 0.5 is 30 units. It's her total daily dose. That's the answer to that. What is her basal dose? So she takes 30 units total. Half of that is 15. So 15 for her basal dose, and her pre-meal target is 120, and her post-meal is less than 180. So that's, she has, unique targets for her blood sugars that we're going to try and work toward. And that's usually set by the provider endocrinologist in this situation. For her carbohydrates, she takes 1 unit for every 15 grams. And her hyperglycemic correction factor is 1 unit for every 55 above the goal of 120. So she uses this thing called the 1700 rule, and that's just a way to determine insulin sensitivity. So I'll just explain this because a lot of people ask me about this. And we usually mostly use it for type 1s. It seems to work the best. But what we're trying to do with this formula is figure out how much 1 unit will drop your blood sugars, how sensitive you are to insulin. So you take 1700, this is just the number they came up with, it's a mathematical formulation, divided by your total daily dose equals your insulin sensitivity. TDD means total daily dose. So I take 1700 divided by 30. That's her total daily dose equals 56. So this tells me 1 unit drops her blood glucose 56 points. That's the 1700 rule. And we use that a lot with type 1 if they're on Novolog, Humalog, or Apidra. So if we translate this into a chart, it looks like this. She takes 1 unit for every 55 more than 120. And if she's less than 70, she actually subtracts 1 unit. This is very important. So if I'm going to have 60 grams of carb and I'm supposed to take 4 units to cover 60 grams, if my blood sugar is less than 70, I'm going to take 3 units to accommodate for that low blood sugar. If her blood sugar is at target range, she takes no additional correction insulin. And if it's above 120, she starts adding 1 unit for every 55 above her target. So she's going to use this chart to help instruct her. So let's just take a look. Cindy's How do we adjust in these bolus with insulin ratios and carbs? Well, before lunch, her blood sugar is 285, and she's going to eat 45 grams of carbohydrates. So she would say, my target is 120. So how much am I over target? Well, she would take her before lunch blood sugar is 285 minus what she is currently. I mean, I'm sorry. Her current blood sugar is 285 minus her target tells her she's 165 over target. She takes 1 unit for every 55 over target. So we take 165 and we divide it by her ratio or her sensitivity factor. And we know she needs 3 units to cover for that hyperglycemia. So 3 units is her correction scale, what dose, what she needs. Okay. Then she's going to eat 45 grams of carbohydrate, and you divide that. She takes 1 unit for every 15 grams, so that's 3 units. So she takes 3 units bolus to cover, to correct her hyperglycemia, and she takes 3 units to cover carbs. So that's total adjusted dose is 6 units. Let's just say her blood sugar is 230. So if her blood sugar is 230 and she plans to eat 60 grams of carbohydrate, how much insulin would she need? All right, I'll just go ahead and, well, this should say 230 minus 120 is 110. She's 110, so she's 110 over her target. She takes 1 unit for every 55 above her target, so that means 2 units to cover for hyperglycemia. She's going to eat 60 grams of carb, and she gives 1 unit for every 15. So that's 4 units. So you take 2 to cover hyperglycemia, 4 for carbs, 6 units of Humalog to cover for that meal. So that's the very basics of a person who's carb counting and a person who's covering for hyperglycemia. And that's what we're using in the hospitals a lot. It's called basal bolus, you know, therapy. And that for the bolus part of insulin during meals, we cover not only for the carbohydrates they're going to take in, but also we cover for hyperglycemia. So it's a carbohydrate or prandial coverage plus a correction scale. That's another way they talk about it. So in this situation, she would need 6 units. So to wrap up with some insulin teaching keys, I'll do one more poll because I think the polls are kind of fun. Which of the following is a suggested teaching key for patients who are on insulin therapy? What are some critical things they need to know? All right. Thank you so much for voting, everyone. So I'm going to go ahead, just take one more second to vote. Okay, so the right answer is all of the above. So let's talk about this a little bit because this is a nice summary. You want to make sure you test, inject, and eat. And I call that TIE for my patients. Test your blood sugar, inject your insulin, and eat. And you want to do that within, you know, 10 to 20 minutes. You don't want to test and then wait around and then give your insulin and then wait and then eat. No, you want to combine these three activities very close together. Abdomen is a preferred injection site. We used to tell patients to rotate arm, leg, abdomen. We love the abdomen. It has the most subcutaneous fat and it really absorbs insulin quickly. It's really great. Using a Sharps container is very important to dispose of your insulin needles. Really critical because if you throw them in the trash man can get stuck with them or the sanitation workers and they have to get tested for HIV and hepatitis. So really encourage them to get a Sharps container. Always have treatment for hypo available. Where should they have treatment for hypo? In their car, by their bedside stand, on their person at all times. Those are really, all of those are critical teaching points. The other thing, there's a few other ones in here. Don't reuse the fine syringes because the needle gets dull from poking it into the vial and then poking it into your skin. So it gets a lot duller each time you do that. And so if a patient says it hurts to give an injection, you might want to evaluate, are they actually reusing the needle too many times? And you want to keep the unopened insulin in the refrigerator, and it's good until it's expired. Once you take it out of the refrigerator and start using it, it's good for 28 days. You want to just make sure you watch the patient withdraw their insulin and inject it. Can they do it safely? Can they get to the right dose? had a patient who couldn't see the insulin syringe, so we got him this MagnaGuide that actually magnifies the syringe so he could see the numbers and be independent in his insulin injection. And we want to go over side effects, and if they're using insulin pens, make sure they know how to put the needle on, to prime the needle, and how to inject that. So these are some really important insulin teaching keys. We want to make sure before the patient leaves our office or leaves the hospital that they can give the insulin injection safely and accurately. And we want to follow up with them. And if they've been on insulin for a long time, ask to see their injection sites, because sometimes if they've been on it for a long time, they keep injecting in the same place and they can get hypertrophy in that area and the insulin isn't absorbed as well. They can get a Sharps container from BD. Here's a safe clip needle clipper from BD where you can clip off your needles and it stores them for there's if you take it 4 injections a day, it would store a year's worth of needles. And then you just can throw the barrel into the trash and this into a Sharps container. They're like $5. You can find them at pharmacies. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining this webcast on insulin and pattern management. I would really encourage you to take this information and apply it to your patient situations so that you can really make this information come to life for you and kind of calculate how much insulin patients need based on their body weight, what would be basal, what would be bolus, and how much they're currently on, and feeling comfortable to reaching out to providers and suggesting changes as needed. And so we're going to close the webinar, but I will stay on if you have any other questions. Have a great holiday, everyone, and I will see you next year. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.